From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fillmore District.
Vernal Heights.
Oakland, California.
Coming up, we'll visit a creative writing class at San Quentin.
I am Oscar Grant. I am Trayvon Martin. I am you.
We'll hear inmates talk about whether they had to go to prison to change their lives for the better.
I definitely don't believe that you need prison in order to change, that, you know, that is the mechanism of change.
Then we'll find out how hackers are trying to solve urban problems by bringing everyone together.
We think it's important for technologists to have a chance to talk with people that are going through the food stamps and government assistance programs.
We're reporting from the inside out today on Cross Currents. It's a tense time in California prisons right now. A hunger strike that started 2.5 weeks ago is ongoing, with more than 700 inmates in 10 state prisons still refusing to eat. The strikers are demanding reforms to their terms of incarceration, like indeterminate segregation and confinement practices in the SHU, or the Security Housing Unit. Supporters say more than 3,000 inmates statewide are currently stuck in units like these indefinitely. Many have been in the SHU for decades because there's no clear policy on how to get out. But state prison officials say they've put a pilot program in place that provides a clear path out based on the inmates' behavior and ability to demonstrate their independence from a gang.
Most of the people who are what they call validated as gang members are associates of gangs, not people who have engaged in any gang activity. And that's where the real tragedy comes.
Laura Magnani works with American Friends Service Committee. She represented the interests of inmates in a meeting with prison officials on Monday. She says most of the segregated prisoners are involved in gangs. But the problem is that California's Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation defines gang involvement too broadly. Also, inmates could be kept in long-term isolation for things including
having the wrong books, having the wrong symbols, having the wrong tattoos, talking to the wrong people.
As the hunger strike continues, officials say there are no plans to negotiate with prisoner advocates, nor the prisoners themselves. More than 30,000 inmates refused meals on the first day of the strike, which began on July 8th. There will be demonstrations in Oakland and Sacramento next Tuesday. When we think of prison, most of us don't think of it as a place where people go to get an education or to learn how to express themselves. But the arts have been part of the California prison system since 1977. Even though state funding for these programs was completely cut in 2003, nonprofits have kept some of the programs alive. One of those is Brothers in Pen, a creative writing class for San Quentin inmates taught by Zoe Mullery.
Doing art causes you to be self-reflective in a way that causes you to think about what it means to be a human being. And I think that it's that kind of self-inquiry that may be part of what helps someone take a different path when they're on the other side of the wall.
Even though proponents argue that the arts help prisoners reform themselves, Mullery says prison officials can be in a difficult position when deciding whether or not to allow these kinds of classes.
You know, it's very hard because on the one hand, people want rehabilitation. On the other hand, they want inmates to be punished. And so if they're publishing an anthology and it gets on the radio and someone talks about it and says something nice about it, someone's going to give the prison some flack and say, what are those inmates doing getting a creative writing class? You know, their victims don't get creative writing classes for free.
Earlier this month, students in Mullery's class held a reading of their work in San Quentin. KALW's Julie Kane and Kyungjin Lee were there and bring you this reading by Noble Butler, an inmate who read an excerpt of his story, I Am. It's been 10 years since his brother's murder.
Bang! Bang! Shots ring out, echoing through his head. He struggled to wrap his mind around what was going on, where he was, and what was happening to him. It was night. That's all he knew. for sure, and that it was cold. Dearly beloved, the preacher begins, we are gathered here today not to mourn, but rather to celebrate the life of his rich baritone voice is somber, but its old school Southern Baptist cadence is beckoning. A heartsick, soulful wail rises up from the sanctuary, reminding some in attendance of a wounded animal. He continues, we didn't have to be gathered here today. Oh, no. We should be here celebrating good times. We should be commemorating blessed events. But instead, we must be that village that comes together and lends our strength to a grieving mother and father and lay to rest one of our own children. It wasn't supposed to be this way. All he was doing was heading home from the store after getting a snack of Snapple and Skittles. He didn't realize that in between the time that he left out the front door to the time that he started back, that the laws in that state had changed to state that it was a capital offense to be a young black and to wear a hoodie in that neighborhood, or that the people who lived there had been given posse comitatus status to carry out the punishment on sight. This child was loved, the preacher blasted at full volume. By now, he had raised the congregation to a fevered pitch. Some would say the Holy Ghost had come and laid hands on folks up in here. There are even episodes of laughter in between the tears as funny anecdotes are shared. Do you remember the time when, girl, there was this one time he, oh, child, I can think of the time when she, but even in the midst of these lighter moments, it's impossible to forget that this congregation is missing one of its members, that one of the most important stars in this congregation, in this constellation, has fallen from the sky. Occasionally, someone would steal a clandestine glance towards the gleaming treasure chest resting at the foot of the altar up front and be reminded of its contents, the totality of one woman's most precious prize, the fulfillment of a man's bloodline. And somewhere in the back of their minds, they will swear they could hear the heart-wrenching bleat of that wounded animal. She was just hanging out with her girls, kicking it at the park, enjoying a mild February evening. Her friends never tired of her stories about her trip to D.C. or performing for the president. And not just any president, the first black president. And he was from Chicago at that. She reminds them that the inauguration was also in the same year as the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Had a Dream speech and the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. She connects them to a rich history, reminds them that they are more than just some Southside projects, infuses them with dreams of tomorrow until chaos erupts at the other end of the park and a metallic wasp moving faster than the speed of sound and with no concern or conscience for whom it stings, strays from its intended path and instead bites her once, giving her sleep, but stealing away those dreams. It was just after midnight, January 1st. Happy New Year! The world held so much promise for him as he and his friends rode the BART back home to the Fruitvale station. At 21, life was just beginning to open up for him. He chatted with his friends and watched the world pass by out his window as he pondered at all the possibilities the new year would bring for him. The promises and possibilities would forever remain unfulfilled. When it came time to explain, 5-0 said he couldn't tell the difference between the weight of a taser and a Glock, something any 12-year-old kid in the hood could tell you. But it's all right, though, because he was sorry. But is sorry enough? The preacher asked, imploring the crowd. The mother, no longer able to suffer in silence, howls out in pure agony at the question, letting that be her answer. Hell no! Someone yells and leaps to his feet, turns and storms out the church. Others turn to look and follow. Soon, the whole congregation is in the streets. One by one, residents of the neighborhood, all colors and creeds, opens their doors and joins the gathering and growing crowd. They create a mighty procession, a sea of people deeper than any ocean formed since time began, and press forward. They arrive at the grave site, and the sea parts, allowing the mother to come forward with the treasure chest containing her most precious prize. And they lower it, returning it to the earth and God, that which is his. And as the first clumps of dirt begin to fill the hole, a chant rises up. Soon, it is echoing through the crowd. I am Oscar Grant. I am Hydea Pendleton. I am Sandy Hook Elementary. I am Trayvon Martin. I am Michael Butler. I am you.
That was San Quentin inmate Noble Butler reading an excerpt from his story, I Am, written as part of the Brothers in Pen creative writing class at San Quentin State Penitentiary. To find out more about the Brothers in Pen project, visit our website, kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. We just heard from a prison inmate who's part of a creative writing class at San Quentin. The public was invited to the reading, and one of the audience members asked the inmates if they thought going to prison was the only way they could have changed their lives for the better.
A lot of people, and I am not one of these people, believe that it's great, everybody has degrees, you're writing, but that if it wasn't for prison, that then this transformation would never occur. And I really hate that thought. I don't like for people to think like that. And I wanted to know if you guys agreed or disagreed with that thought and why or why not. Because I heard you said that it did help you. I would like to think that there's something we could do before it gets to this level to inspire that same transformation. At least I'm trying to do that for my son.
For me, I have to say yes. Because my lifestyle was so different coming up in a broken home, just my mother raising 13 kids, introduced to drugs and alcohol real early in elementary school. It was just so different. So I never thought about nothing like this. You know, about 10 years ago, things started to change for me. But I made a conscious decision that if I used to tell myself, if I change the way I think, I can eventually change the way I live. And then fortunately, when I got here, I had been trying to get here for about 5 years. When I got here and got involved in Patton College, that really allowed me to start getting back into writing and expressing myself. And then I was introduced to the creative writings class. And so I would say yes for me, you know, because I think about that a lot today. If I had not came back into the system this time, I'd probably be dead, most likely. And I've never got back involved to what I'm doing today.
I want to respond to your question, too. Most definitely, prison is a place where a person can come and correct their negative behavior. I'm from Oakland, California, and the homicide rate in Oakland, California is roughly at between 115 and 130 people a year. That's a majority are involved in the street life, you know, drugs, negative activity. So when you look at the equation from that perspective, you see that if a lot of us would not have come to prison, we probably would be dead or be in, you know, worse off condition. Now, the thing is that there's a time for punishment, there's a time for discipline, but there also should be a time for restoration, especially when you have accomplished some of the things and you are ready to be productive and learn the work skills and the education. Then it's time to move us back out into the streets, because a lot of us didn't know the things that we know now. And that was the primary cause of us making the negative choices that we did.
Emil, then
I think that there's merit to the fact that, yeah, it's some people who come to prison, that's why they change. But I think that there's another side to the story, that a lot of us, you know, we were getting in trouble when we were children, right? And when you're getting in trouble, your growth is arrested. And so you come to prison as a child, and then you grow up. So then you change because you grew up. But unfortunately, it's too late. We grew up too late.
Well, Tani will be the last one for this question.
Yeah, I'd like to take another position on I understand the fact that you said that prison is a place where you can change, but that's only because there's nothing outside that could be in place where this prison is not necessary. I mean, prison is only here because, you know, people saying that it helps you, because, you know, there's nothing outside. You know, even if you could have stopped at an early age, like when you were a child growing up, there were some things in place outside of prison that this thing could have been totally unnecessary. So to me, prison is unnecessary. It's only a place that's in place now because people don't have these alternative roads outside. So I definitely don't believe that you need prison in order to change, that, you know, that is the mechanism of change. So
those were the voices of Kimya Humphrey, James Metters, Emil DeWeaver, and Watani Steiner. They're members of the creative writing class Brothers in Pen at San Quentin State Penitentiary. Do you think arts in prisons are important? Let us know. Leave us a message on our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. The Brothers in Pen shows how creating something from scratch, whether it's a piece of writing or a business idea, is a process that often goes smoother with the support of a community. In some circles, that collective creation process is called hacking. Over the past decade, that term has made its way into the mainstream in relation to things like credit card fraud or national security secrets.
The term hacking is associated with these negative things, but at a base level, hacking is taking something apart and putting it back together in a new way.
That's Mike Zuckerman, a self-described culture hacker, who's one of those people who consider the term as being more about creative innovation. He's worked on everything from an eco-conscious nightclub in San Francisco to plastic pollution reduction in Kampala, Uganda. Since June, he's been running an experiment in civic hacking with a group of other activists in downtown San Francisco. The idea behind civic hacking is to bring people together to find new solutions to urban problems. Their project is called Free Space, and it's housed in a 14,000-square-foot vacant building at Mission and 7th Street. Its founders describe it as a temporary space for lasting change. The project has been so successful, its organizers were recently invited to the White House's Champions of Change program. KALW's Jen Sheehan paid Free Space a visit, and she brought back this sonic tour.
When I meet Mitsuru Muraki, he's jamming on some DIY percussion instruments, two round glass vases, and a couple of pencils. We're in a small room on the third floor of this former sewing machine factory, where Muraki and another musician named Gabe Stern are writing a song together. That is a metal bucket.
You guys recording?
Yeah, we sure are. You make music?
Yeah.
And just like that, another collaborator is added to the mix. Muraki and Stern themselves just met about a half hour ago. But this kind of thing is exactly what's supposed to be happening here throughout the entire building. This is Free Space.
The mission of Free Space is to foster creativity, community, and civic innovation through the gift of free space.
Morgan Fitzgibbons is one of about 10 organizers of the project. It began in coordination with a 48-hour hackathon called the National Day of Civic Hacking. A hackathon is when people get together for a set period of time around a particular challenge. They work like crazy, a lot of times without sleeping, and then present their ideas at the end. But the Free Space founders wanted to go a little deeper. Here's another organizer, Mike Zuckerman.
What we really wanted to show is, yes, that's a great format to state a problem set, to form teams around it, come up with solutions, present them. And we just really wanted to extend that over a longer period of time.
So, through a creative broker, a friendly landlord, and some crucial support from the mayor's office, they got a one-month lease on an empty building in the city's mid-market district, all for the princely sum of $1. The concept of free space was inspired by community projects like the Commonwealth Club, Fela Kuti's Shrine, Burning Man, and the Diggers. They were the legendary theater and activist group from the 60s that brought the ethos of free to San Francisco. Again, Morgan Fitzgibbons.
Diggers do, right? That was one of their taglines. Diggers do. And they weren't into making demands of the government or protesting or anything. They just went out and made things happen.
On June 1st, they opened their doors. They didn't have much of a plan other than to offer the three floors of space to people with ideas for improving the city. Almost immediately, free space started taking shape. Yoga classes popped up, then donated furniture and equipment, a bike sharing program, even a giant slide. There were flower giveaways, clothing swaps, modular gardening, and tons of art projects. I find Shirai Chen crouched in the narrow stairway up to the second floor, scotch taping paint chips to the wall in the shape of a tree.
This is actually my first site-specific art installation, so it's super exciting. I actually created these raindrops out of microfiche, and then I made the sun out of all kinds of random images and collage.
Chen is the executive director of Scrap, a creative reuse center that's been around since the 70s. She says the communal spirit at Free Space has made her art project easier and more fun.
Yeah, I was actually making the sun on Solstice Day, and they had a bunch of people here, so I had like 6 or 7 people helping me glue fun things together to make the sun, so it was awesome. And this is kind of exactly what Free Space is about. It's sharing what you have with someone who needs it.
I pass a kitchen on the second floor where something smells delicious, and then find my way to the third level with high ceilings and wood floors. That's where I meet F.J. Alton.
Well, I'm a street artist, and by street artist I mean I'm homeless and I'm an artist and I sell my art to survive.
He shows me one of the pieces he's recently finished.
It's a replica of the St. Peter, St. Paul Cathedral, and it's made from my heroin paraphernalia.
Alton says a stranger on the street told him about Free Space last month, and he's been spending pretty much every day here since. He says it's been amazing to have access to lots of free materials for his artwork.
Actually, before, I really didn't have a lot of supplies or access to different things or different elements, so I used what I could, whatever I could find. If I had to shoplift it, I would.
Now he's taking shifts welcoming visitors at the front desk. He says Free Space already feels like one big family.
I've learned a lot about community, and my artwork has actually gotten different and better since being around these people, and they give me inspiration, and, you know.
I think it's only possible here. And I think one of the things we're most proud of is the diversity and backgrounds and ages and socioeconomic status of people that come together in Free Space.
Again, organizer Mike Zuckerman.
And that's because it's inclusive, and there are no real barriers to entry to get in here.
Zuckerman says when it comes to solving our city's problems, this kind of diversity is just as important as technology.
It's not just getting together Stanford PhDs in a room, it's really getting a cross-section of society.
Free space is already inspiring the creation of other projects as well, like the Learning Shelter. It's a 90-day housing plus job training program for homeless people that will be run out of a shipping container. On a recent night, there's a kind of hack within a hack, or a day-and-a-half hackathon at Free Space, to help the project come to life.
Thank you very much, everybody, for coming. This amount of support is absolutely phenomenal and amazing.
About 35 people are sitting on donated couches and chairs to listen to Mark Roth, the man spearheading the project. Roth himself was formerly homeless.
So what everybody has signed up for and touched my heart with is coming here to try to figure out how can we build this into something concrete, a full formal plan.
The Learning Shelter is already well on its way. 5 donated shipping containers sit outside next to the garden, and tonight a diverse crowd has gathered to help. They'll make a logo and website, figure out curriculum, and work on outreach. Organizer Mike Zuckerman says this cross-pollination of ideas and thinkers is one of the greatest strengths of Free Space.
We think it's important for the intellectuals to be inspired by the artists and the technologists to have a chance to talk with people that are going through the food stamps and government assistance programs to have a better understanding, because it's really hard in regular society for those people to sit down and converse with each other.
So it makes sense for Free Space to be located in the mid-market area. It's generally a low-income neighborhood, but tech companies like Twitter have recently been moving in as part of an intense urban revitalization plan. Some people say it's gentrification.
But for us to just be here and say, you know, this is not only important, but it's really cool and fun, and it's something that you should probably be engaged in, is sort of a, you know, shot across the bow of sorts to just let people know it's okay to make a lot of money, but it's what you do with that money that's really the important thing.
And it seems there are a lot of people who agree. Through an online campaign, Free Space raised $25,000 to pay rent on their building for one more month. A month of workshops, lectures, conversations, murals, and songs, like the one Mitsuru Muraki and Gabe Stern started, which ended up gathering 10 more musicians before it was done. In San Francisco, I'm Jen Chien for Cross Currents.
You can check out Free Space until the end of this week. There's a closing celebration on Saturday. For more information, go to klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now it's time to reveal our audiograph sound of the week. All week long on KALW, we've been playing it for you. Here it is.
140.
We asked what you think it is and where in the Bay Area it's from. KALW's Julie King climbed 308 steps to visit the windiest and foggiest place on the West Coast and brings you today's answer.
Ladies. My name's Julie Kane.
Hi.
I'm a reporter from KALW, which is one of the NPR stations in San Francisco.
Oh, cool.
And I'm just doing a little audio postcard about the lighthouse.
Oh.
Can I ask you guys a couple questions?
You can just record us breathing. And then you can say that's what it's like to climb back out.
Would you introduce yourself to me and tell me where we are right now?
Oh, I'm Barbara Poyser.
And I'm Lou Ann Wolf.
And we are here at Point Reyes National Park, right on the coast. And we're looking at the lighthouse from, I don't know, how far are we up?
We're a little more than halfway up the 308 steps.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And we were just talking about how for how many years, 70, 100 years, that people manned this station and kept it clean. And the lamps burning and the lenses polished. And then it was replaced by those kind of crummy looking rusty little electric bulb and a foghorn that runs on electricity. Like, oh, all that time and all those man hours and those lives that it took to do this, and now just flip the switch. It feels very unromantic, and we felt sad.
And do you live locally, or where are you guys from?
Sonoma.
That was nice that you just said that in stereo.
Yeah.
We do our best.
Was it worth the 300 and...
Oh, gosh, yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, just to sort of experience what it was like down there. And I always do this, go to this place of, okay, you're in the midst of a 7-day storm, and it's unrelenting, and the wind is lashing at the building, and your supplies are running out, and you're doing everything you can, and they're trying to get food to you, but the roads are washed out, and there's floods everywhere. Yeah, so it's romantic.
They prevailed on. They did it. Those lighthouse keepers. It is romantic.
This was a hard one. I didn't get it. But one of you knew exactly what that was. Congratulations, Charlie Lavery. You're our winner this week, and we're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. And Rosie and Charlotte, your dad really did win.
I want to marry a lighthouse keeper and keep him company. I want to marry a lighthouse keeper and live by the side of the sea.
For the rest of you, we'll have a new sound next week, so tune in. In the meantime, visit KALW.org to hear more from Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature.
We'll take walks along the moonlit bay, maybe find a treasure too. I love living in a lighthouse.
And that does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Today's team includes Julie Kane, Marco Choi, Audrey Dilling, Ben Wu, Laura Flynn, Megan Quintana, Nina Gensler-Debs, Christian Rose, Kyungjin Lee, Holly McDeed, Mary Reese, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And Casey Miner is our senior editor.
Real rural. Real rural.
Rural.
Real.
Real rural.
Rural. Was that good?
A very happy birthday to Casey today. She puts the kale in KALW. And thanks to you, we're listener-supported radio. This is Beth Marlin. The San Francisco resident is well known for her music for children. But on Saturday, she's playing for a 21-plus crowd at the Hop Monk Tavern in Novato. For more information, go to KALW.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.